Yes.
President Cahill, our Senator Wilkins, Senator Ward, Senator Donnelly, Senator Hoffman, Senator Osterman, and myself, Senator Kelly. We have before us, first of all, the removal of the members of the Permanent Fund Board for cause, and Senator Donnelly has a conceptual amendment on that.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move to add an effective date on January 1st, 2004, and incorporate that effective date into the title.
Objection?
Yes.
Senator Osterman?
Just for discussion, huh?
Senator Donnelly?
Well, to give the public a chance to examine this, the governor felt so strongly about it in his veto message that he must have some good meritorious reason for being so strongly opposed to this. So if he has changed, it's an assumption there may be members of the public that could come down and lobby for a change before it went into effect.
Objection maintained?
Yeah, I don't quite understand.
Essentially, what happened is the governor has fought this bill because he came in and wanted to remove the other people on there. And when we said we should remove people for cause, he vetoed the bill so that he didn't have to abide by that. And now that all his people are in place, he wants to not veto the bill so that his people can only be removed for cause. So we're going to start with a clean slate with the new governor, essentially. That's what the effect of the amendment is. We start with a clean slate with the new governor. Senator Wilkins?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I understand the amendment. I'm a little troubled because the amendment pulls us into what we're trying not to have happen. We're politicizing this thing, and that's not what we want to do. The board today is a functioning board, and I think by all reviews, they've done a good job. And regardless of who brought them in, they've worked hard at it, and I would hope that we just do what we want to do here, and that is remove politics, and we could do that by not ourselves putting on another layer of politics. I would hope that we, I understand what Senator Donnelly is going to do, but I would hope we not add an effective date 3 years from now.
There has never been any way in the history of the state of Alaska that we could have ever predicted a governor so political as this. And the use of statutes to gain his political agenda, dealing with the Permanent Fund Board, was, I think, very egregious when he vetoed something that I think was in the best interest of the state. And now that it protects the people that he has in place, he wants those people protected. My only thought, the reason I agree with Senator Donnelly's amendment is new governor, new rules, all the people that were in under the old layers of politics were the guy who pushed the envelope on at every level. I mean, this is the guy who put his name picture on the permanent fund check. We start with a clean slate with a new governor. I support the amendment. Senator Austin?
If we don't have an effective date until 2004, why don't we just vote this down? I mean, there's no reason to even have it out there then if that's the case. I agree with you at all. We're just going to politicize it even more. There's not really anything we should do to do it. If that is really, the issue here, the concept for cause is a good deal. I mean,
Mr. Chairman, I think the question before us is whether or not it makes good public policy to remove members of the board only for cause. Makes a lot of sense to me. When the Permanent Fund Board members came to talk to me, that was the dialogue, and I think it makes good sense. I voted for it the last time, and I intend to vote. vote for it again this time, but I am opposed to the amendment.
Mayor Wilson?
Mr. Chairman, looking at the roster, it looks like all four members that have terms that expire were expired by the effective date of the amendment.
Not at all. After that, beginning in the year 2004, that would be the state law that would go into effect.
Okay. Any other comments or questions? Any?
Senator Olson?
No.
Senator Austin?
No.
Senator Lane?
Yes.
Senator Hoffman?
No.
Senator Raymond?
Yes.
Senator
Boyd? Yes. Senator Wilkins? No. Senator Romney? Yes. Senator Tully? Yes.
IDA
for me? Oh. Mr. Chairman, I'd move Senate Bill 92 as amended with the accompanying crystal note from committee with individual recommendations.
There's objection. You need to speak to that?
Same thing as before. I think the bill is useless, and I don't see any reason to have this type of a bill out there if it's not something.
Senator Green?
Yes.
Senator Hoffman?
No.
Senator Lehman?
Yes.
Senator Olson?
No.
Senator Moore?
Yes.
Senator Wilkins?
Yes.
Senator Austin? Senator Romney?
Yes.
Senator
Kelly? Yes.
Yay, three.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
great,
yes.
That brings up before us Senate Bill 193. We're going to take a brief at ease as we get the a new CS passed out here, Senate Bill 193, and a sponsor statement. Just going to look through it there. And essentially, what it does is speaks to a court decision that happened, I believe it was Lindley versus Malone in 1990. And probably the person who could comment on that best would be Senator Donnelly. Can you give us kind of a brief little discussion on what Lindley versus Moore was on the affirmative fund and the residency requirements?
Well, I don't remember that was the name of it, Mr. Chairman, but in 1988, I sponsored legislation to change the residency requirement for the permanent fund dividend from 6 months to 2 years. That's the case you're talking about? Yes, that's what it was called, right? So 13 years ago. And we put a little savings clause into the bill at that time that said that if the court found that 2 years was too long, it'd go to 1 year. And at the time, we did a lot of research and found out that the longest acceptable period of time under U.S. Supreme Court decisions for benefit was 2 years. And they had opined that that was okay where there was a transient population and a unique or special benefit being offered, such as with in-state tuition fees. As a specific example, they had to take residencies for in-state tuition fees because they said if you let anybody to move to your state get in-state tuition and not make them wait a while, well, then people would tend to move to your state just to get the discounted rates to go to school. And that seemed to be right on point for the permanent fund since it's unique and very attractive to people to move to get cash. And that's back when the dividend was a lot less than it is now. So the Superior Court, Judge Faye, I thought wrote a reasonable opinion, and she said, you know, two-year residency might be appropriate if the state had evidence that people were moving to Alaska to get the dividend. Because then it would fall under the same category as the U.S. Supreme Court allowing a two-year residency for the in-state, out-of-state tuition question. But the state, despite my request, had not taken the time to develop any evidence on it. And so that time we decided to make a choice not to appeal the case up to the Supreme Court until we could sometimes develop enough data to prove our case and back it up so it would be constitutional and go to a longer residency period. So we still doubled the residency period from 6 months to 1 year with that legislation, but the 2 year was just kind of left in limbo. And what this legislation proposes to do, Mr. Chairman, is to conduct a study to see if it can be determined whether or not there is a serious problem with people being attracted to our state because of the permanent fund dividend, and that would justify going to a longer residency period within the constitutional guidelines.
Senator Austin, longevity bonus program, we've already basically phasing that out. There's no new entries into it anyway. But
it also increased the residency, but then for longevity bonus to 1 year also. But the problem, well, then after that, then we went to the phase out.
Questions? Self-explanatory, and it does have an amount of money attached to it.
Mr. Chairman, I move the proposed committee substitute.
Thank you, Senator Donnelly. Are there objections to the version J, adopting version J as the workaround? Hearing none, version J is adopted. Senator Lehman?
Chairman, it seems to me things that deal specifically with the permanent fund, and when we do efforts, we've done lawsuits to defend the permanent fund that we have actually used. I don't remember the account name, permanent fund receipts or whatever.
Permanent fund earnings reserve account. Permanent fund earnings reserve account.
Permanent fund earnings reserve account. Maybe Mr. Keel or somebody from his place making. They can tell us. But instead of using the general fund, it seemed to me that that would be an appropriate source of money when we are specifically working on efforts that will end up saving the permanent fund earnings. And so I would suggest that I offer that as a suggestion.
Do you want to offer that as a conceptual amendment?
I'll offer that as a conceptual amendment.
I doubt that Mindy was able to hear everything that you said.
Am I too far?
Could you repeat that a little louder, please?
I move an amendment one to the CS that would change the source of funds from general fund to permanent fund earnings reserve account. Is that, if that's the correct account.
Are there objections?
Object.
Senator Ward?
I don't think I want to find it.
Okay. Andy?
Mr. Chairman.
Oh, Senator Wilkin, I'm sorry.
I would just want to make sure that we're leaving open the, if it isn't the earnings reserve, there's something else. I'm not sure you want the earnings reserve. You may want something that is some statutory designated receipt of some sort.
I want somebody who knows more about those account names to step up and tell me what the right account name is.
My staff is calling Wedge Finance right now. And we'll hold this bill aside until she can come back with the answer to that question.
But doing the right study will increase the dividend.
We can develop this. We can end up saving the dividend, maybe increasing the dividend.
Well, what was wrong with the funding source at hand?
We want to spend those dollars to maintain the speed.
Next is Senate Bill 149. Okay. The bill relating to the Kenai prison facility, private prison, excuse me, House Bill 149. And this is Chenal that is carrying this bill, sponsoring this bill.
Do you want me to move that first, or do you want to take that one first?
Could you come up and speak to the proposed CS? Is it version C.A? Is that correct? Version she wants to move? Is the version T.A that you want moved?
Actually, has a CS.
W.
Yes, it's W.
Donnelly,
Mr. Chairman, I would move for discussion purposes to the committee back before it's the W. Any substitute version?
Sue, could you speak to the W version and the changes that were made in that?
Yes, first of all, I'd like to thank gentlemen and madam for having us here and express my regret that Representative Schnault is caged in caucus and can't make the meeting himself.
State your name and affiliation, probably.
Carolyn Wright. I'm a staff member for Representative Mike Schnault from Nikiski.
Go ahead.
The bill actually itself is very simple. It moves the authority from Delta Junction to the Kenai Peninsula Borough. The changes that were made since passage of the House were two. While I get myself a little bit more organized. On page two, line approximately 24, references were removed from AS 3630, the State of Alaska Procurement Code, because there was a potential conflict written by the AG's office, a constitutional conflict, that required that we remove that section from the bill and ensure that competitive procurement processes were followed within the Kenai Peninsula Borough using their own ordinances, resolutions, and procurement procedures. The second change was quite simple, and that's on page 3, line 3. The Department of Corrections, in a meeting quite recently, had some concerns with opening a prison and paying for 800 beds immediately upon opening the prison. And so we allowed what is called ramping or titrating, allowing them some time to come up to speed, moving in with, say, 50 prisoners or X number of prisoners, whatever they decide when the building design is finished. Other than that, I'm going to defer to the borough and other experts that are here.
Yes, thank you. Margo?
Excuse me, don't you have three on your W? On W?
No, I only have two.
I have three. I'm special. I'm special.
Which TA? A W. W is TA. 1, 2, 3.
Okay.
Mr. News, could you Senator Donnelly,
some of this is missing page 3.
Yes. Actually, Senator Donnelly, I think she was making reference to page 3 on the former, that the previous CS and version W only has 2 pages.
Oh, okay.
And that was incorrect. W
may have
11
or so pages. I don't know.
But I know it has more than 2 now.
My name is Margo Knuth. I'm with the Department of Corrections. Thank you for hearing from me this evening. This bill is an outgrowth of House Bill 53 from several years ago, which authorized both a replacement jail in Anchorage and a private prison in Delta Junction. As we sit here this evening, the Anchorage jail project is about 65% complete in its construction, and it's expected to come online and be open for business in less than a year from now. The Delta Junction prison proposal became mired in a number of obstacles, one of which was the selection by the federal government of Delta Fort Greely as a preferred site for an anti-ballistic missile program. In the interim since then, the community of Kenai has come forward and said that they would like to be the location for a private prison, and that is, I think, the genesis of House Bill 149. When Governor Knowles signed House Bill 53, authorizing a private prison at Delta Junction, he indicated that there were 5 standards that he believes should be considered whenever we're looking at a correctional facility project. And those five standards are safety, comprehensively meeting statewide and regional needs, consistency with best correctional practices, involving community participation, that is a government-to-government relationship, and cost-effectiveness. In a letter to the Honorable Dale Bagley, who's the mayor of the Kenai Peninsula Borough, dated October 30th, 2000, Governor Knowles indicated he set out these principles again, and he noted that the Kenai private prison idea may meet those important objectives, that he was sure there was plenty of discussion to come, and that he hoped that Kenai would Commissioner Pugh informed of the latest developments. The safety and consistency with best correctional practices cannot be known at this time. That's going to be, I think, a product of negotiations between the Department of Corrections and Kenai for what type of facility they're contemplating and standards for operating it. The proposal obviously does involve community participation. It's a government-to-government transaction. And that leaves two issues. One is comprehensively meeting statewide and regional needs, and the other is cost effectiveness. And I would like to note that the administration introduced a bill several years ago that not only expanded prison beds in Alaska, but also would have expanded our regional jails. And most especially, we have urgent jail needs in Fairbanks and in Bethel. And when we refer to jail beds, those are pretrial detainment beds or beds for short-term misdemeanors. We could have 2,000 prison beds in Kenai or in Anchorage or wherever you might put them, and it still wouldn't help or address the problem of those people who need to be close to the court where their criminal proceedings are occurring. The legislature has not yet acted to expand the regional jail beds, and I would be remiss if I didn't point out this evening that there is still an urgent need to do that. So while this might, and I think will help meet our statewide needs for prison beds, there still remains out there a regional need for jail beds that I hope the legislature will take up and will address in the near future. In terms of cost effectiveness, we do have a concern with the bill as it's currently drafted, and I have sort of two concerns. One is on the procurement process. The bill, as initially drafted, had provided that the Kenai Peninsula Borough should procure one or more private third-party operators through a competitive process similar to the procedures established in AS 3630, which is the state's procurement code.
Excuse me, can we have a page and line that you're on so we can follow
you? Yes. Senator, in version TA, that was on page 2, lines 24 and 25, and in version W, it's page 2, lines 23 and 24. And the sentence is that the Commissioner of Corrections shall require, in the agreement with the Kenai Peninsula Borough, that the Kenai Peninsula Borough procure one or more private third-party operators through a competitive procurement process. And version TA had the additional language similar to the procedures established in AS 3630, State Procurement Code. Those words have been dropped from version W, and I have a concern that in dropping them, I've not had an opportunity to speak with the sponsor of the bill to know why they've been dropped, but it raises a red flag for me that we know what a process similar to the procedures of the State Procurement Code would be, and in dropping it, it makes me wonder if the intent is to not require something similar to the State Procurement Code. Mr. Vern Jones from the Department of Administration is here this evening, and he would be in a position to address what's required by the State Procurement Code. The next sentence then says that a municipality exercising its powers under statute that follows its municipal ordinances and resolutions and procurement procedures satisfies the procurement requirements of this subsection. In a letter to Representative Pete Pott as chair of the House Rules Committee, Assistant Attorney General Marcy Van Dorn on April 16, 2001, raised a concern that when the bill first says, hey, he and I should use a procurement process that is similar to the state's procurement code, and then in the next sentence says that doing X satisfies the procurement requirements of the subsection, that raises a separation of powers issue for the Department of Law. Ms. Van Dorn is not here this evening, but I just note that that is something noted in her letter of April 16th. The second and last concern that I would like to address is on page 3 of version W. Actually, it starts at the end of page 2 and carries over to 3. And in section C, this legislation requires, it says that the lease must have a minimum of 800 prison beds, and the lease payments must be sufficient to cover, A, the cost for the development and construction of the facilities, and B, the operating cost for a minimum of 800 prison beds in the facility for a period of 5 years, less a reasonable period to achieve full occupancy. With the private prison that the state's using in Arizona, we just have contracts that go for 3 years that we pay a per diem rate for each prisoner there. We're paying a rate of, I think it's $54 a day. And for every prisoner that we have there, we pay this rate. When we go over a certain number, the price goes down. I think when we have 1,100 prisoners there, it was something like $52 a day. If we have more than 800 prisoners, it's $55 a day. If it drops below 700, it's something else. But anyway, out of that money, Arizona Prison, which is a CCA, Corrections Corporation of America prison, they pay their capital costs and the operating costs, and it includes some amount of money that's appropriate for their profits. This proposal is different in that the state is going to be required to enter into a 20-year lease with Kenai where we guarantee payments that will cover the capital costs of the prison. And in addition to that, this legislation requires that the administration also pay the operating costs for a minimum of 800 beds for a period of 5 years. There is a provision now in version W that says less a reasonable period to achieve full occupancy, and I appreciate that provision. It recognizes that you don't start a prison with a full capacity because you've got to have several months period of time where staff become comfortable with the operations, and it's unsafe to do other than a stair-stepping approach where you'll have 200, then you'll add 50 in 2 weeks, and you'll add another 50 or 100, and it'll take several months. But what this does require is that after we do get up to step, that the intent here is that the state pay for 800 beds for 365 days of the year. The intent language is $89 a day, whether we use 800 beds or not. And that's the part that is a concern. As an example, we had an outbreak of tuberculosis at the Spring Creek facility. And that meant that we had to quarantine the people who were there for a period of time. And nobody could, you didn't want to bring anybody in because you did not want an exposure there. And so your numbers dropped from what is what we usually have. But even in the best of circumstances, it is very difficult to hit 800 on the head. And the state's business practice with the private prison in Arizona is that we pay for the prisoners that we have there. We believe that for a cost-effective proposal, that would make more sense. I would be happy to answer any questions that you might have. Otherwise, thank you for considering these remarks.
Margo, could you more further explain the separation of powers issues on that page 2, I think it was?
Mr. Chairman, I can certainly try, but it would be better, I think, coming from Marcy Van Dorn or somebody else who is now with the Department of Law. I have actually moved to the Department of Corrections, and so I hesitate to offer legal advice. But what Marcy set out in her letter is that in the second sentence, which of paragraph B, page 2, line 21 to 24, requires the Commissioner of Corrections to require in the agreement with the Kenai Center for the Borough that the borough procure one or more private third-party operators through a competitive procurement process. So in one sentence of the bill, it directs the Commissioner of Corrections to do something. The Commissioner has to require that the borough use a competitive procurement process. The next sentence says, at the same time, the legislature is here to tell you that if the municipality does this, that satisfies the procurement requirements of the subsection. And so Ms. Van Dorr has cited cases that if you are asking the executive branch to do something, you should let the executive branch do that. And the dichotomy set up here is, on the one hand, the executive branch is asked to do something, but then the next part of the legislation directs what the answer is supposed to be. And that raises the separation of powers issue.
Thank you. I'm going to go to the Kenai LIO right now for testimony, and we have a number of people to testify, and I'm going to ask you to keep it to 3 minutes. I've got a little timer going here, and when it beeps, I'm going to ask you to wrap it up. And we will start with Mr. Ronald Rozak at the Kenai LIO. Mr. Rozak.
Yes, my name is Ron Rozak. I live at 36641 Chinelna Drive. My concerns for this bill are as follows. And I was out of town during the time some of the action took place this spring. Basically, I feel that, in essence, the borough is sole sourcing what can potentially be a major project on the peninsula to Cornell, in as much as their contract for the first phase, which is planning a promotion, allows with, or has language that states the intent is to negotiate a phase two. And another place that talks about them having the first opportunity for phase two. Moving along, I guess I'm also concerned that this contract in language deals more with them assisting, Cornell assisting the borough to sell the project to the legislature, basically overcome opposition that, or deal with local people's opposition or concerns, but the whole intent appears to be to keep this thing moving along in what I see as, or would label, a fast-track project. And I don't think a fast track is appropriate for this type of project. This has long-term impacts for the area. In addition, the borough mayor and assembly waived the requirement for a vote of the public, which is required on capital projects in excess of $1.5 million. And there's a reason for that, you know, going to the voters. Normally you have enough information presented that people can make a decision on it. I also have a question as to why the language specifically states 800 beds minimum, when maybe the feasibility on this should also look at a lesser amount that may be acceptable if 800 beds isn't acceptable to the people in the area, assuming that we're going with a private versus state-operated facility. I personally have reservations about a privately operated correctional facility. I'm not going to say I 100% oppose it, but I don't have enough information yet on Cornell or the privatization to say I would vote in favor of it. In the past 3 years, I've traveled in the lower 48 through a number of states where you see a sign along the road that warns you not to pick up hitchhikers for the next 10 miles, and then it's a prison in that area. I get concerned when I drive through that area. My time is up. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. I'm going to go to Mr. Marvin Weeb.
Good evening. This is Marvin Wiebe. I work with Cornell Companies, and I'm officed in California. And I called in this evening to answer any questions that you might have along the way, but also I'd like to address one issue that I have heard as I've listened to testimony this evening, and that's specifically...
Mr. Wiebe?
Yes.
We're really struggling to hear you here.
All right. I'll try to speak up a little louder. Are you able to hear me more easily?
Yes.
I'd like to address one issue specifically that I've heard raised a couple of times this evening, and that's with respect to why a contract might be anticipated with an operator like Cornell, with a borough that would permit an occupancy or assure an occupancy payment of 800 beds. I'd like to make two or three points with respect to that. Number one, this is not atypical in our industry. There are a variety of reasons for that, but most notably, the Federal Bureau of Prisons has converted all of its contracting to a minimum guarantee of at least 95% occupancy on larger prisons than this particular one is anticipated. And those contracts provide an incremental payment for everything over 95%. Contracts are for 10 years, and that is not the only example of that that we can cite. There are states who have similar kinds of contracting arrangements. There are states that pay only on a per diem basis, as noted earlier. But this particular contract is a little different for a variety of reasons, one of which is it's in Alaska. A private operator like CCA operating in Arizona, operating 2,500-bed facilities, of which Alaska only occupies about 800 beds, is able to bring in inmates from other states, which is not really a feasible strategy for a facility up in the up in Alaska. And at the same time, they also have access to federal inmates, particularly in the Southwest region, such as immigration inmates or also inmates for the U.S. Marshal Service. So they're able to have a more flexible way to keep their facility full, which would not be the case with this particular facility. And that is another reason why we have concern if, in fact, the occupancy were not to be maintained at 800 beds. The other issue is that the per diem here that's being discussed, the per diem equivalency, is really 18 to 20% below the statewide average that's used for federal calculations in the state. And that 18 to 20% figure is really not a function of a negotiated number in the sense of putting down all the costs that one would assume is going to be part of the facility. It's just a fixed number, a fixed cap that's been determined that would be appropriate for a private operation. And my time is up. I can elaborate further if you wish, but that is our concern.
Thank you, Mr. Wiebe.
Asking a question.
Senator Osterman? Yes, please.
Yes, sir. And would you get back closer to the mic? We really lost you after you got talking. You just went back to your same voice. First off, you talked a little bit and we couldn't understand much of it, but you talked about 95% occupancy. You mentioned at one point in time. What were you referring to there?
And I apologize. I'm calling in from California, so I'm not really in front of a mic. I'm on a telephone. I was referring to the Federal Bureau of Prisons, which is in the United States, the Federal Bureau of Prisons handles all the federal inmates, and the Federal Bureau of Prisons contracts a pretty significant number of their beds to private operators. The contracts they have with private operators, including Cornell, are contracts where they contract for 10 years with a guaranteed minimum payment monthly of 95% occupancy. And then they have an incremental per diem that they pay in addition to that. That 95% occupancy payment covers all of the operational costs of the facility. And then the incremental per diem for the other 5%, if in fact the occupancy is greater than 95%, covers the cost of food and some insurance and some electricity and so forth, but it's the incremental differential. Those contracts guarantee that the private operator is able to maintain the facility fully staffed, fully trained, and fully operational. And that's the reason why those contracts have been set up that way.
All right, thank you. You also mentioned it's not feasible to bring prisoners to Alaska, but it's feasible for us to send them out. Is that what you said?
I said that it's not likely, maybe I used the word feasible, it's certainly not likely that states from the lower 48 would probably transport up to Alaska. It's really not a very practical situation even probably now in terms of transport. and so states would probably be reticent to do it in light of the fact that they have other resources among the lower 48 states where they can move other offenders if they needed to.
Thank you. Thanks, Senator Osterman. Mr. DeVar, could you come up possibly? I think you might be able to clear some of these questions up as well. Were there any other questions from the committee? Senator Hoffman, you have a look on your face like maybe you have a question. Senator Wilkin?
Still enough, yeah.
Mr. Wiebe, are you still on?
I am.
Sir, this is an 800-bed facility. Is that with Cornell Company, is that a large facility, a small for you? What's your average bed under management?
Well, we have operations that have over 2,000 beds in them. This is a good-sized facility, but it's clearly not the largest facility that we operate. Generally speaking, prison facilities, if they're medium security or greater, are more like 800 beds and greater. And, for example, we operate a 1,600-bed facility in Georgia that's medium security. We operate an 800-bed medium security facility in Oklahoma, as well as a much larger facility in Texas. So this 800-bed facility is in the ballpark, but not the largest that we operate.
Thank you. And are you a publicly traded company?
We are. We're traded on the New York Stock Exchange.
And your exchange letters?
Our letters are CRN.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wiebe, once again. Mr. Navarro, would you like to present your testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senate committee members. My name is Tim Navarro. I'm the president of the Kenai Peninsula Borough Assembly. I would speak in favor of House Bill 149 and the Senate concurrent or committee substitute. I would particularly like to, if it's at the wishes of the chairman, to have Susan Burke come up because she can probably speak to the separation of powers issue when we get to it. But I would like to take a brief moment to explain the competitive process that the Borough Assembly went through.
You talked a little bit, and we couldn't understand much of it, but you talked about 95% occupancy. You mentioned at one point in time. What were you referring to there?
And I apologize. I'm calling in from California, so I'm not really in front of a mic. I'm on a telephone. I was referring to the Federal Bureau of Prisons, which is in the United States. The Federal Bureau of Prisons handles all the federal inmates, and the Federal Bureau of Prisons contracts a pretty significant number of their beds to private operators. The contracts they have with private operators, including Cornell, are contracts where they contract for 10 years with a guaranteed minimum payment monthly of 95% occupancy. And then they have an incremental per diem that they pay in addition to that. That 95% occupancy payment covers all of the operational costs of the facility. And then the incremental per diem for the other 5%, if in fact the occupancy is greater than 95%, covers the cost of food and some insurance and some electricity and so forth, but it's the incremental differential. Those contracts guarantee that the private operator is able to maintain the facility fully staffed, fully trained, and fully operational, and that's the reason why those contracts have been set up that way.
All right, thank you. You also mentioned it's not feasible to bring prisoners to Alaska, but it's feasible for us to send them out. Is that what you said?
I said that it's not likely, maybe I used the word feasible, it's certainly not likely that states from the lower 48 would probably transport up to Alaska. It's really not a very practical situation even probably now in terms of transport, and so states would probably be reticent to do it in light of the fact that they have other resources among the lower 48 states where they can move other offenders if they needed to.
Thank you. Thanks, Senator Osman. Mr. Navar, could you come up possibly? I think you might be able to clear some of these questions up as well. Were there any other questions for the committee? Senator Hoffman, you have a look on your face like maybe you have a question.
No.
Senator Wilkin?
Still on.
Mr. Wiebe, are you still on?
I am.
Sir, this is an 800-bed facility. Is that with Cornell Company, is that a large facility, a small for you? What's your average bed under management?
Well, we have operations that have over 2,000 beds in them. This is it's a good-sized facility, but it's clearly not the largest facility that we operate. Generally speaking, prison facilities, if they're medium security or greater, are more like 800 beds or greater. And, for example, we operate a 1,600-bed facility in Georgia. It's medium security. We operate an 800-bed medium security facility in Oklahoma, as well as a much larger facility in Texas. So this 800-bed facility is in the ballpark, but not the largest that we operate.
Thank you. And are you a publicly traded company?
We are. We're traded on the New York Stock Exchange.
And your exchange letters?
Our letters are CRN.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wiebe, once again. Mr. Navarro, would you like to present your testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senate committee members. My name is Tim Navarro. I'm the president of the Kenai Peninsula Borough Assembly. I would speak in favor of House Bill 149 and the Senate concurrent or committee substitute. I would particularly like to, if it's at the wishes of the chairman, to have Susan Burke come up because she can probably speak to the separation of powers issue when we get to it. But I would like to take a brief moment to explain the competitive process that the Borough Assembly went through to pick a team. And they picked a team that, as one team and a private company that's responsible for designing, building, and operating a prison, financial risk to the state is minimized, and the savings is avoids the lawsuits and one side saying, well, this wasn't in the plans, and this was. That's why we did it that way, because we did not have a set of plans for a prison that the Department of Corrections wanted or that had an 800, nor did we have any type of criteria for a operating agreement. What we did have is the community's willingness to consider a prison in its backyard, and we proceeded to go through a process to select this team that would bring to the borough and the state the security that it needed, but also to the borough where it was going to get its employees, how it was going to train those employees during the construction phase, how they were going to build the facility, who was going to build it, what subcontractors were they going to use, were they going to use to the extent possible union labor, what kind of wages in the operational part of the facility would they pay. We as a community did not want $8, $9 an hour wages. We wanted $14. The state's minimum or starting wage is $14.79. We also have a comparable, or the team that we picked had a comparable retirement package. Not quite the level of the state, but fairly close. When we went out for an RFQ, we sent out approximately 30 packets to different companies and every major correction company, private correction company in the country. We got 4 bids back, which included the team to design, build, and construct and promote the operation or the prison. 3 of the top 4, or 3 of the 4, are the top 3 correctional companies in the country. One clarifies themselves as the third largest of adult prisoners, and the other is the third largest with adult and juvenile prisoners. And then the company that houses the prisoners currently in Arizona also bid on it, and they're the second largest in the country. Wackenhut, who's the first major, did not bid on it. And we had another company from California that I think is 6th or somewhere down the line, but still up there that bid on it. We went through a very competitive process. It was very open and fair, and included all the factors that I said. We had an evaluation committee that evaluated them, and then the borough assembly sat in executive session with the top 2 at the request of the evaluation committee to make the final selection. And we did it all in one day without any lobbying on any behalf on either side. That's how our finance director wished for us to make sure we did one in the morning, one in the afternoon, and immediately met and totaled up our points and made our decision. It was a very close total, but Cornell Companies, Inc. Won. They had a very good involvement with the Native Association and Native programs, which in some cases, for some members of the assembly, was a nice aspect that they wanted to bring. Some people might not know it. There's only about 7 or 8% of the population of the state of Alaska is Alaska Natives, and yet 35% are those that are incarcerated in Alaska's prisons, either in Arizona or throughout the state. We feel that. And our finance director, who's in charge of our procurement, and our legal staff feel that we went through, and we can defend our competitive process that we went through. And we only ask now that the team that's put together, that includes all of those factors that I stated about jobs and involvement in the community and community support and that can't always be put into numbers, be allowed to be the team that works with the borough and the Department of Corrections, because as all this bill allows you to do, or allows us to do, is to negotiate with the Department of Corrections to see if we can, under state law and under their best practices, come to an agreement to house the 800 prisoners that are currently being housed in Arizona at a cost of approximately $20 million and bring them back to the state of Alaska. And I know that there'll be an increase, but those dollars will be spread in Alaska, spent in Alaska. And we also then have the better ability to work directly with our prisoners that are incarcerated for rehabilitation and try to reduce the recidivism. And with that, because I'm not very well to speak to the issue in the committee substitute with the separation of powers, I would like Susan Burke, if it's okay with the chairman, to come forward and speak to that for me.
Just a moment, Senator Osterman, and just for the committee's
information, you'll notice that we have a memo prepared April 17th from Mr. Luckup, our legislative counsel, regarding the separation of powers and special legislation issues regarding the bill. Senator Usman.
Thank you, Mr. Yeah, Mr. DeVar. First, I want to preface my remarks by saying that I'm totally in support of a private facility in Alaska, and I think it's the right way to go. But some of the questions that get raised and flagged is the cost, obviously. If their average cost, according to this, in letter 10, or the intent part of this, is $89 a day, and we just heard testimony and found the average cost is $54 in Phoenix or in Arizona. Both of them, I assume, have extracted transportation costs out of it, so we're really dealing with those two figures of 89 versus 64. Is that your interpretation?
It's not. In Arizona, that, you know, you have to deal with what it costs the state of Alaska to operate in the state of Alaska, the cost of food, the cost of, medical is separated, the cost of construction, all those factors come into play that Arizona doesn't have included in it. But you are correct. I think they'll pay him $56 or $62, somewhere in that neighborhood, and up here it would be $89. It's about $7 to $8 million difference is what you'd be paying.
About 35-40% difference.
Senator Donnelly,
just trying to get a,
I think Senator Donnelly has some information that might be helpful to you.
Trying to get a current understanding whether the 54 is a true figure or not that we're dealing with.
I defer to Senator Ward. I think he has the answer to this.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, 54 is not a true figure. There's other costs that are involved in it. Right now, the costs that we're identifying this year are only $16.5 million that we're sending to Florence, Arizona, subject to the operating budget coming to a conclusion, which it will someday. But there are other costs that are involved in it, and they are directly relating to us sending the 1,000 people to Arizona. It's just as simple as that.
Do you happen to know what the dollar number is?
No, I've asked the department, and so far we haven't been able to determine that total cost. It's in administration, and we have some medical costs here.
I remember we had this discussion a few years past, and I heard numbers in the 70s when you factored in all the costs coming out of House Corrections Committee. Definitely. I don't know what the current number is.
Well, I think it's an important issue, an important figure that we're dealing with, because it doesn't, in my mind, I mean, if I use the figure $54, it's a 40% jump in cost to go to $89. So I think if it's not, 54 is not the real figure, and, I know there's additional cost because sometimes we take prisoners down there for 6 weeks and bring them back.
Mr. Chairman, sometimes we bring them down there for 30 days and bring them back. Sometimes we fly the probe board down there.
Margo, are you out there still?
Mr. Chairman, I do have information.
Could you comment on this, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a document that I'd be glad to share with the committee, and the department has been struggling with trying to come up with what the costs are for cost of care for inmates, and it is a difficult process. What we have at this point is that the Arizona contract cost is $54.57 a day, and there are additional items on it. Inmate medical is $2.79. Transportation is $1.76. This is per inmate per day. If you calculate it out, they come up to be significant sums. There's and so the total cost of care for inmates who are in Arizona is $62.42 per day. What you would compare that with is the contract price that's being proposed in House Bill 149 is $89 a day, but to that you must add inmate medical, transportation, and the same things that get added to the Arizona cost. And in fact, medical is more expensive in Alaska because it's provided by Alaskans. Medical providers, which cost more. And so to the $89 a day, you add these sums, and it's $104.88 that an inmate in the proposed prison would cost. If the state were to build a 800-bed facility in Kenai, and if the cost of that facility was $110 million, and that number is pulled out of the air, we have no way of knowing at this point what it would cost to build an 800-bed prison in Kenai. The work hasn't been done. But suppose it costs $110 million. Our per diem operating cost is $65.92 per day. We would have a capitalization cost on top of that of $33.48. And then there are the items that I've talked about already. And so our cost would be $116.79. So Arizona is the cheapest at a total of $62.42. This proposal would total $104.88. And if the state did it at $110 million, it would be $116.79. It would be cheaper if we expanded Palmer and Wildwood, cheaper if we expanded our existing facilities than if we built a new one. But it gives you some effort at a cost comparison.
Senator Osborne?
Although Commissioner Navarro made a statement that he anticipated it would be $7 to $8 million additionally each year. Do you agree with that?
I'm sorry, he testified what?
That it would be approximately $7 to $8 million addition each year.
That is the additional, the difference between the contract price in Arizona and the contract price for the proposed Kenai prison is about $8 million. The contract price in Arizona is $16 million. Kenai would be 24. And so, yes, you're about one-third more.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Ward.
Thank you. I don't remember what it is, but you're familiar with the, and I guess this is for either one of you. Incidentally, just so that everybody knows, and I'll do this on the floor, my Native corporation owns the ground, partially, that this is going to be built on. The other Native corporation involved in it, I have inherited stocks coming to me, and my wife does real estate for both of them, but we're not involved in it, just so that I do have a vested interest in this, and I will disclose it on the floor. But in Arizona, are you familiar with a recent Alaska Law Journal that stated that it's a constitutional right for a prisoner to receive rehabilitation?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ward, I am familiar with that law review article.
Are you familiar with the article saying that being incarcerated in Arizona is a violation of that constitutional right?
Through the chair, the article suggests that the Supreme Court of Alaska should find that it's a constitutional violation for the inmates to be there, but it acknowledges that the court has not done that, and that's where we are at this point.
And if, in fact, we were to bring these 1,000 people back home, give or take, but if we brought them back home and we're able to rehabilitate and stop recidivism of 140 of them, for every 20 people, it's 22 people, it saves us $1 million a year. I think this would be a worthwhile venture to undertake, since maybe they are right, it might be causing a little bit of problems for constitutional rights as far as recidivism goes, and not just among the Native inmates, all of them.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ward, the department firmly believes in rehabilitation efforts and trying to reduce recidivism. Without a doubt, that is the most cost-effective approach to correctional practices.
And you think the difference between this might help reduce recidivism amongst the inmates that are in Arizona, and if so, be a cost saving to the state, or do you think it is not?
I apologize, but I don't believe I have enough information to know that.
Well, from your conversations, since you've been, Mr. Chairman, if I might.
Senator Ward?
You've talked to inmates in Arizona and the parents of them, as I have, and from the various villages that are involved in it that have tried to be visiting, but it's very hard to fly to Arizona to visit. Do you think that contact with the family, with the elders, and with the community might possibly cause somebody not to reoffend as compared to being in Arizona with no contact?
Through the chair, Senator Ward, I have been to Arizona. I went there recently with members of Cornell and Kenai Borough to show them what the state of Alaska considers to be a good medium security prison. And I am very impressed with the programs that are being offered to Alaska Natives in Arizona. It is surprising. And so I consider that a factor that would need to be balanced in when you're also weighing the disadvantage of not being able to have ready visitation, and that's what leaves me uncertain about how the rehabilitative prospects of inmates are in Arizona compared with Alaska.
Is it one-fourth of recidivism to do with family and community involvement in the community?
Through the chair, I apologize. I don't know that.
That is the answer.
So at the very least, one-fourth of the people that are down there, regardless, they are condemned because they don't have contact with the elders and their uncles and their wives and their community in Alaska. They're in the desert. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, Senator Ward, we've got quite a few people signed up to testify. I'd like to go out and get the public testimony in as quick as possible.
Yeah.
So, okay. On the teleconference line, let's go to the Anchorage LIO. Richard Van Hutten, are you there?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm here.
You limit your remarks to under 3 minutes, please?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Richard Van Hutten. I am currently the president of the Correctional Officers Bargaining Unit of the Public Safety Employees Association. I represent approximately 670 correctional officers from across the state, and my home is in Kenai. I am speaking here today to argue against the bill appearing before this committee. Now, this bill, should it be passed, is not only bad for the Kenai Peninsula, it's bad for the entire state as well. This bill is so restrictive as it's written, and it only allows for what will be the most expensive of options to be made available to resolve the state's prison bed space problem. This, to me, does not make any sense when the state is considering income taxes, sales taxes, and changes in the way the permanent fund is distributed. This bill lacks even the most basic protections or guarantees that might ensure that that the unrecommended privatization of this state service would save money for the state of Alaska. It has already been determined in federal court that the contracting out of prison services doesn't mitigate any of the levels of liability associated with prison operations. Privateers compare their rates that they will charge to the state with the costs of operating prisons in Nome or Bethel or Ketchikan. The result is there will be no real savings to operate the prison in Kenai. Also, there's no guarantee in the bill that the people who are hired to work in this prison will meet the current state standards for correctional officers. At this time, the Department of Corrections cannot find enough qualified people to fill the vacancies that are available working for the state. Although I agree that Alaska prisoners must be brought home to serve their sentences, I feel they should be brought home to state-operated correctional facilities. Being from the Kenai Peninsula, I can tell you that there is much more public support for a state-operated prison over a privately operated one. The more and more this issue is talked about on the Kenai, there are more and more people speaking out publicly against this private prison project. If it can be done, I would like to see it made possible for the Kenai Peninsula Borough to negotiate directly with the Department of Corrections to provide the most cost-effective, publicly acceptable method for incarcerating Alaska's prisoners. And I thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you, sir. We'll go to the Kenai site. The next person signed up to testify was Marge Hayes.
I'm Marge Hayes, and I'm from Sladotna, and I'm opposed to HB 149. Some of the considerations that I have had, I read in the paper a quotation by one of the legislators that everyone on the Kenai Peninsula wanted this prison, and I thought I'd better speak up. There are a few of us who do not. I did not go to the hearings, and I should have. Even the hearings were not unanimously in favor of a prison. I would prefer not to have even another prison on the Kenai Peninsula. I hate to see us become the peninsula prison. We already have two, and we have a juvenile detention center coming. However, a private one seems very unwise to me. One of the things that Rick just now mentioned was that they're having a hard time keeping the positions filled now out at Wildwood. Overall, in the United States, they are having a hard time. Guards have to take an awful lot of abuse, and private prisons are noted for paying Walmart sale wages. In Arkansas, they have lost 42% of their officers in 99. Oklahoma, it was 57% of their officers. In Kansas, they're bringing in 19-year-olds to watch over murderers and rapists and so forth. They can't keep guards. I think about our community. If we do have a private prison and they are paid these low wages, I think about the people that will make money from it will be some real estate people and some developers of low-cost housing projects. But what happens when those projects then start turning over with people that can no longer afford them, who are quitting their jobs? I know that you do save money if you don't, and Cornell and all private prisons are out to make money. You do save money if you don't pay good wages, and also if you cut down on their benefits compared to state benefits. And by the way, I don't think the guards out here in our state are paid any too much. If you cut back on the benefits, what happens if a person needs some health needs that are not met through their benefits? Who's going to pick up that? I've got lots of questions. Let me just throw out the questions here. It seems to me that nothing has been said about rehabilitation that would go on there. I'm wondering about the construction. If it's shoddy, who picks up the bill for that? Private prisons are known for very poor management. I think about that Birmingham. I believe there were six inmates that escaped in January. And their security record is pretty low compared to a state-run place. That's it.
Thank you. Did you want to wrap up your comments?
Oh, I'd love to. One last thing. Kenai Peninsula, I think, is the most gorgeous place on Earth, and it would really change the culture of our peninsula with our popular river and our beauty and so forth, having another big prison come in, and especially a private prison. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to take just a real quick at ease, and for those of you online, we're not going to get to SB 115 or SB 153 tonight. So I'm just going to take a brief at ease for a moment, and we'll continue public testimony on this bill.
No shame.
Are we taking a dinner break now? Okay. You can have that. I can get it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I don't see it.
For what? Let's have a good one. And we're back on the record. We're going to continue with public testimony. And make sure where we're at here. Mr. Richard Segura in Kenai.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, thank you for your time. Yeah, I'm Richard Segura, and I'm the president of the Kenai Native Association, and I am speaking in support of HB 149. I have a vested interest in this project. More so, I think, when I began to study about prisons, and especially in Alaska and the incarceration rate, our interest became more of a compassionate one than it did monetary, because I was unaware of the disproportionate number of Alaskan Natives that were incarcerated. And I began to meet with the Native leaders throughout the community and the state, and garnered a lot of support. So we'd come together, and one of the things that we would like to do is some programs within this prison system geared towards our people. I want to state, I'm not saying that we're after a Native prison. My gosh, I wish there was never a prison, period. And we would accept anybody that would like to be a part of the programs. But it's very important for our people to help our own people. I don't think the state, they're trying, I guess, but I just don't think that they're doing a good job. And that's my own personal belief. But I am speaking in support of it, and I would encourage passage of this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Segura. Mr. Price?
My name is James Price. I reside in the city. I'm speaking as a private citizen. I have questions regarding the sole source issue. I don't believe it's right to award an enormous public contract to a private contractor without allowing bids from other competitive bidders. I believe our borough signed a contract which awards Cornell up to $100,000 if they're required to submit to a competitive bid process. I'm against this. I don't think that it's right, and I don't believe that the community supports this. We haven't completed, before we even completed public testimony, and we have a feasibility study that we've yet to conduct, and I just feel that this is coming down at us way too quickly. I think it's wrong to award Cornell $100,000 of our borough's money if we choose not to allow them to build and operate our prison with our money on their terms. Our only relief from this is for the legislature not to approve the project during this session, and I encourage you to try to relieve our borough taxpayers of the obligation that our borough has made to Cornell in this $100,000 gift to them if you pass this bill. I question what the real costs are going to be in House Bill 149. There's an expectation of savings of 18% to 20%, less than what they call the current all-state facilities rate. While this does sound like reasonable justification, this is only intent language, and there's no assurance at all that there would be any cost savings. Also, as far as the size and the scope of this project, I believe a project of this size should be approved by the vote of the people. When we should be providing more concrete answers from responsible parties. So far, essentially, we're arguing against smoke and mirrors, as no one has come forward to give the public any real facts as far as what the pay is going to be to the people who are going to be employed here, and what the effect this is really going to have in our community. And I'd like to see our borough or some responsible party answer relevant questions with factual answers before we're committed to any further liability. Also, as far as the borough, there's a liability issue, and I question what the real cost is if Cornell fails to be responsible. Who's going to pay restitution and civil penalties that the incarcerated prisoners could assert against our Kenai Peninsula Borough? I've just got a lot of questions, and there really hasn't been any answers. I've heard that Cornell was awarded this because they were the lowest bidder in the IFQ. It's my understanding that in the RFQ that Cornell was not first, they were second. And I've got a lot of other questions, but my time is up, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak to y'all. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Ms. Elsie Hendricks?
Yes, this is Elsie Hendricks. I am in support of House Bill 149. I ask that you pass this bill. I believe that this bill would give the Kenai Peninsula the economic boost that we so desperately need. I believe that it would help our Kenai Peninsula residents directly and indirectly. And it would also keep the Alaska money in Alaska, and it also would help bring the people, our people who are housed down in the other states, it would bring them back to Alaska. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hendricks. Ms. Susan Wells?
Yes, this is Susan Wells. I'm a resident of Kenai. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you tonight, Mr. Senator. In listening to the testimony, I am thinking about cost savings to the state, and I do believe that this project will save the Department of Corrections tax dollars. And as a taxpayer, I would prefer that my tax dollars are spent in the state. I prefer that we pay Alaskans for services for Alaskan prisoners. I prefer that we Alaskans take care of the prisoner issues and that we take care of our own people. I think that the rehabilitation of our people is more effective when it's done on our own turf. And I can relate to you a true story of a person I just talked to day before yesterday whose brother was incarcerated in Arizona. He was paroled and had to live down there, got in some more trouble, and he is now in California. And in talking with the family, they've related to me that had he been home, they would have been closer. He's got brothers and sisters here. He would have been closer to their family where they could support him emotionally and help them in with regards to the to his rehabilitation. So this issue, that even though I'm concerned about costs and wanting to see that that the state provides for this at home, there's a personal issue with the people. Had it been my brother or my cousin or something, how could I go down and visit them and help with the support them? It would be very difficult. So with having a prison here on the peninsula, it's more accessible to the family members who want to come in and visit and help with that issue. I think that this is a great project for this peninsula. We already have a prison here, and it hasn't been a problem for our community. And it's secluded. It's away from the public view. This prison that's proposed would be right next door. I have confidence in the borough assembly and their process for choosing the team. I believe that the RFQ process has complied with the state regs. And I believe that the team will work with the Department of Corrections in doing and providing the maximum security and the best care for our prisoners. And I believe that KNA and Mr. Segura and those on the board would also be a security for me to make sure that that is done. I just urge you, I hear my time is up, I urge you to support House Bill 149 and the Kenai Peninsula Borough's efforts in this project. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Wells. Mr. Mike Carpenter.
My name is Mike Carpenter. I live in Kenai. I support House Bill 149. And what I've been hearing is there is a local concern. I think the main concern from most of the people that are against this project are wages. And I feel like the state will succeed in getting a fair wage for the workers that work out there at the prison. And I'm trying to understand why the prison guards themselves are so against this prison, because I think they're gonna when you have a bigger circle of employees, the good ones are going to rise right to the top. So also I think Arizona, there's a lot of hidden costs at the prison that the head of the prison system in Alaska are not telling us. She's saying $67.17 and stuff like that. I don't think they have it down like that at all. I think there's much more hidden costs. I think there's probably a lot of escorts going down there and staying for a week or so and coming back, and I think there's a lot of money wasted. It would be just like a factory moving to Mexico to save money. We don't need to have that situation here in Alaska. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's see, the next to testify is Ms. Carol Segura.
I'm Carol Segura, and I live at 320 Thompson Place, Kenai. I feel that all Alaskan prisoners should be incarcerated in the state for economical reasons, as well as giving us the opportunity to help them to prepare for their release. I also think the state should consider parole officers in the villages. It's a shame that our people have to walk the streets in the cities in order to report to their parole officers. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Van Hutten, have you been called on yet?
Yes.
As well as B. Hubbard?
No, just
Bennett.
Look on the old sheet.
Okay. Okay. D. Hubbard?
Thank you, Chairman. My name is D. Hubbard. I reside currently in Anchorage, and I'm building a house in Sterling. While I feel that we should have all of our prisoners home, I question whether a sole source contract is the way to do it. I have been looking at reports that other state legislatures have compiled, and some of their information is quite interesting. The Washington State Legislative Budget Committee looked at this in 1995, and they made recommendations that any privatization should include a legislative requirement for cost savings, should set design and construction standards to lower costs, should develop a contingency plan in the event a private contractor ceased to operate a facility, should place an on-site monitor at the facility to assure the contractor complies with legislation and court-ordered mandates, and should establish comparative efficiency and effectiveness criteria to permit subsequent evaluation of the private prison. A report that was done presented to the International Conference on Penal Abolition on May 12th of 2000 says public officials are tightening the requirements they write into requests for proposals and contracts. They are strengthening their capacity to monitor contract compliance. They are beginning to fine companies by holding back payment where services are found to be deficient. And they are terminating contracts and, in a few cases, have assumed control and are running facilities where contracting has brought more problems than benefits. Phoenix, Arizona, the legislature in 1999 approved funding for a new prison, but the authorization included a prohibition on segregating inmates in the prison by race, ethnicity, or nationality. Further, there is a quirk in the federal tax code that removes exemptions from prison bonds if more than 10% of prisoners are out of state. If state prison officials are reluctant to have their prisoners housed out of state, or if large cities with severe overcrowding are unwilling or unable to pay to transport local prisoners hundreds of miles. I just question, is there anything in here that's going to say that we are not going to accept any prisoners except those people that are Alaskans? Because I haven't quite seen that yet. There's another recommendation.
Ms. Hubbard, could you...
I'm just almost there.
Okay, thank you.
That state legislatures, the legislators, should pass laws that would require corporations that take over public services to keep their books open to the public. Contracted services should be evaluated annually to see if programs should be returned to public control. So I, along with that, I have some other information that I will be very happy to send down to you, including the Corrections USA Prison Privatization Resolution passed in February of this year. Thank you so much.
Yes, could you fax those to us, please?
Yes, I will.
Thank you. Mr. Slezak?
Yes, I'm here. I'd like to strongly...
And a private company that's responsible for designing, building, and operating a prison, the financial risk to the state is minimized, and the savings is avoids the lawsuits and one side saying, well, this wasn't in the plans, and this was. That's why we did it that way, because we did not have a set of plans for a prison that the Department of Corrections wanted or that had an 800, nor did we have any type of criteria for a operating agreement. What we did have is the